It's very hard to talk about co-production with policy if we are unable to co-produce knowledge with our peers who are just coming from a different knowledge domain, right?
Hello, and welcome to Economics for Rebels, the podcast of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Up until recently, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered and the earth was finite. This rebellion must bring a major shift to economic thinking. Our podcast is dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations in conversations with scientists, experts, activists, pushing for rapid and radical change for people and planet. Welcome to our podcast. I am your host, Alexandra Kovács, and you are listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. When it comes to environmental issues, it is crucial that policymakers rely on scientific evidence, while scientists become conscious of how important it is to provide relevant and comprehensive information on their work to policymakers. In our ambiguous post-truth world, this is no trivial challenge. Today's guest, Esther Kelemen, tells us about the current state of affairs in science policy interface and the challenges that this encumbered liaison poses not just to both sides, but to environmental policymaking in general. Esther is an ecological economist, former vice president of the European Society for Ecological Economics. She's a co-founder and senior research fellow of the Environmental Social Science Research Group in Budapest, Hungary. Her main research topics include the socio-cultural and deliberative valuation of ecosystem services, the transition to sustainable agri-food systems, and the critical understanding of science policy interfaces. She has been engaged in the work of the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services since 2014. Welcome, Esther.
Hi, Alexandra. Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Traditionally, we believe that scientists simply provide reliable data and information to policymakers, and then policymakers can act upon them. And I think from the history of ecological economics, we can safely say that this is definitely not happening too efficiently. And something probably needs to be changed, either in our attitude as to how we believe this should happen, or in the practice of maybe dynamically co-creating policies. But before we go into what needs to be done, let's talk about what has been happening and where we stand today in terms of science policy interface. How do you see this now?
So the term science policy interfaces, or SPIs in short, are used to refer to organized interaction between science and policy, or policymakers and different knowledge holders. And there are already numerous examples for that. So if we consider at the global scale IPCC or the IPBES, the Intergovernmental Panel on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, these are well-established, well-known examples, but also SPIs exist at national level or even local scale, where local decision makers like a mayor bring together a council of researchers and work together on a specific policy problem. So also in terms of the structure, SPIs can show huge variability. Some of them are very hierarchical, well-organized, very structural, and some of them are less formal, more problem-driven, actually. If I consider the beginning of your question, actually, yes, indeed, what we saw that even though we have these lots of examples nowadays, and we know that more and more researchers are getting engaged in SPIs, what we also see is that there is not so big impacts visible on the actual policy decisions, right? So in the last couple of years, after the COVID pandemics, some very critical papers have been published focusing on these failures of science policy interfaces and also identifying some of the reasons of why these SPIs are not really making a big progress in terms of contributing to better decisions. If we also consider why or what are these reasons of why these are not working very well, what we see is that SPIs are still focused mostly on elite knowledge providers like academics, researchers, highly ranked researchers, and they are struggling with opening up to more diverse forms of knowledge. And also they see many times this interaction between science and policy as a linear process where science provides responses to policy questions and then policy may decide whether they would like to act upon it or not. But actually, to be really efficient or effective, I think that a more co-production-based model should be applied, where the focus is on the policy problem and solutions are sought together by different knowledge holders.
But in that case, it means that both parties need to change. They both need to change somehow their actions and their attitudes. And so basically to get this transformation, we need significant changes, both on the side of politicians and also of scientists. Let's now focus on politicians first. I believe that politicians would have to move beyond the realpolitik, which is now what's really governing them, and see that immediate interests can quickly turn into disasters. But I really don't see how that's going to happen and how co-creation of knowledge is going to transcend that kind of attitude. How do you think this shift is ever going to happen?
Yeah, this is a question where I would like to see the answer also very much. So I do not know, I think, the perfect answer. But I think that somehow the solution is indeed in this co-production model of SPIs. And I can bring up an example from one of my previous projects where we established a policy innovation lab. At the national level, it was focused on agricultural issues, or well, rather agri-environmental issues. And that was a very, how to say that, a very problem-focused, issue-driven interaction with policymakers and us researchers. And we tried very hard to bring the problem of the on-the-ground land users to the policymakers. So we try to bring these two main actors closer to each other and provided facilitation, organized several field trips and meetings where both of these actors could meet and could discuss. We provided professional facilitation also so that this co-production model could really work. And it was not just, you know, bringing people in the same room and then waiting if a nice outcome will happen, but really established procedures and structures that helped the equal participation of these different actors. And in this case, in this project, we really felt that we could make a difference. After 4 years of working together, we really saw that some of the key policy actors became open towards the ideas which were raised by the farmers on the field. It's a big question whether such kind of close collaborations can be realized at higher scales, at the European scale or at the global scale. I'm pretty unsure about that. But I have this own experience that it can happen at the national scale. And I think it's very promising because it also means that mindsets can be changed. It's not a short process, so it takes years. Probably it's not the quickest way of making a policy reform or a policy change, but probably it's a robust way of making such a change.
And when we come to the scientists, the challenges there are also, I think, quite significant. Most of the scientists are good at what they do, and that is examining questions with scientific rigor. But when it comes to translating them into policies, and we're only talking about policies, let alone politics, which is one step further, is well beyond their perspective. They look at their own fields, they do their research, and that's it. Can that role change, or does it need to change?
Yeah, personally, I believe it must change. So I think that, well, this is not new for the audience of this podcast. So I think that in this circle, we all understand that stepping out of our ivory towers is absolutely necessary in these times. And basically, this is also what is required from a scientist if she or he is involved in the SBI. A couple of years ago, I had a research where I tried to understand what makes SPIs effective or not. And I carried out interviews with scientists who participated in global or national level SPIs. And I asked them what kind of skills and competencies they needed to stay in this role, to be able to stay in this world for a couple of years. And things which they listed included, for instance, patience, flexibility, the ability of listening to others. I mean, with an open-minded listening. So not just, you know, I'm sitting there and listening and then I just repeating my own things, but really listening to them. Or the ability to make compromises. And I think that none of these competencies are, you know, taught at a university or at a PhD course. So basically those scientists whom I were doing these interviews had to learn these skills and competencies by their own when they were already in these situations. And I think that it's a hard way of improving yourself. So there is always the need to somehow develop our own skills and competencies. But at the same time, I think it's also very important to realize that it's not just about our individual skills, but it's also about our background institutions, the conditions which are provided for us to work. So if you are based in an organization which rewards you only based on the impact factor of your publications, you are simply not motivated to take part in an SBI, right? You are motivated to publish as much as you can. Or the same, if you are working at a university and you have a huge load of hours to teach, then you simply do not have the time to work together with policymakers. And as I said in my previous example, actually, these co-production based SBIs really need time. And by time, I also mean that it needs a genuine involvement or commitment from the side of the scientist as well. And that also needs that your employer is happy with your involvement in such long-term projects. So yes, I think that indeed scientists need to change and the system of science, our institutions, need to change as well.
We're also facing the problem of the post-truth world. I mean, we're talking about really complex and ambiguous problems. And in this world, the credibility of scientists is also changing. You can listen to debates, even when you when you sympathize with both sides. So when I'm not even talking about the extremes, but in debates, you can also hear that they kind of turn into a he said, she said kind of thing. Is there anything we could do about that, you think? Like reestablishing this kind of credibility or provide tools to understand why the different perspectives lead to different outcomes, or that maybe we just have to rethink what the truth is?
Yeah, thanks for this question. I especially like how you ended this. So yes, indeed, the truth of whom, from which perspective? So yeah, well, I have a kind of background in critical social sciences as well. And I had times in my life when I was very eager to see the world in a constructivist way of looking at it, which means actually that there is not one universal truth, but basically we can look at the phenomena around us from many different angles, and from all of these angles, this phenomena will be a little bit different. So in fact, I think that there is this issue with the post-truth world, that actually probably there is not just one truth out there. But what we can do about this is to be open to these different understandings and trying to bring these different understandings to the table, putting them to the table, sharing these, and trying to work out what are the commonalities and what are the differences in these different perspectives. And then based on this, we can perhaps work towards a solution which is acceptable for many of the relevant actors. Actually, what is happening in SPIs, well, I have most of my experience with IPBES. I worked for IPBES for 8 years. So in IPBES, there are established processes where for every key message, the authors have to state whether the given statement is robust and reliable. So we had to assess every statement in terms of how well it is represented in recent literature, and whether the recent literature is consensual about that or not. I think this is also very important, because such an assessment can highlight if there is uncertainties in the scientific understanding of things, right? So we also must face that it's not just, I mean, the post-truth world in a sense that society doesn't trust us scientists, but it also the fact that we are living in a very uncertain world, and from year to year, new research results are coming out, and sometimes these are pointing to different directions, right? So we must also acknowledge that we don't know the answer to everything, or science as such might provide different answers to the same question. And I think that the only way ahead of us is to be transparent about that we are not the persons who can tell what to do tomorrow, right? We are not coming from Delphoi.
I have a favorite quote from Pascal. I'm not sure I can quote it right, but I try. He says that knowledge is like a sphere. The more you have of it, the more it meets the unknown. I think we do have a lot of knowledge and a lot of different types of knowledge, and we must accept that, yes, it raises more questions than what it answers, and we just have to deal with that and being reflective about what perspective we take in that sphere is important, so that we acknowledge we're not like the six men of Induston, you know, trying to figure out the elephant, what the elephant looks like. Moving on to a different topic, when you have these science policy interfaces, you must end up in situations where power and hierarchy comes into play. Is there anything you can do to mitigate these relations, or maybe it's not even clear who's in what position? Sometimes the scientists seem to have more knowledge, while the politicians seem to have more influence, and what trumps what is not necessarily clear.
Yeah, I think that this is a very, very important aspect of science policy interfaces, and maybe not always considered so. I also have some personal experiences of how these hierarchies and power asymmetries work, and definitely one dimension is the power asymmetry between those who are coming from the policy side and those who are coming from the science side. My personal experience is that the power rather lies with those who are coming from the policy side compared to those who are coming from the scientific side. But also within the scientific side, right, who are participating in the SBI, there are many of those hierarchies. Just as a couple of examples, like, I don't know, experts who are coming from Western European, very well-known universities, compared to experts coming from the third world, for instance, or men and women, or seniority, like senior versus junior researchers. Many times I think that these power relations are even hidden to some extent. So again, I'm just going back to my own personal experience in IPES. There are many institutional processes which aim to ensure that there is an equal representation across geographical regions. Also, there is now principles applied to increase diversity in terms of disciplinary background, in terms of age. So I think that we have these, you know, institutional rules to decrease these power asymmetries. But still, there are lots of informal norms, often internalized by those who have less power, actually. So it's not always, it's even not just the case that, and now I'm speaking very personally, that, you know, I'm a scientist, not too old yet, a woman coming from Eastern Europe. I often felt to be excluded, but this is not necessarily the mistake of my fellow researchers. Sometimes it was my own mistake, because I believed that I'm not good enough to make a contribution, to put there an argument, and stuff like that. So sometimes it's our internalized social norms which makes us behave in a certain way, which then just simply recreates all these hierarchies among us. And then going back to the end of your question, what we can do about that? Again, I do not have the silver bullet here, but I like very much the idea of Esther Turnout, who wrote a brilliant paper on that. In that paper, she emphasized that it's not empowerment what we need, but it's the disempowerment of the powerful actors what we need. And I love this idea, to be honest.
Yes, I understand that. I think it's a very strong point. And I'm really glad that you brought this question in of the colonization of knowledge. In a previous Economics for Rebels episode, I was talking to Brototi Roy on the colonization of knowledge. And well, you mentioned where you're coming from, your gender and the university behind you. But in this case, I think it's also a question of financing. Like when you come from a well-financed Anglo-Saxon world, then you simply have more resources to do the research that's needed. So, of course, then you end up having more relevant knowledge. But do you really? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's not easy. And I also think it's not just a resource question. So, but I fully understand and I fully agree that, of course, in a Western university, you have much more resources to do your research. Often you can just count your time spent in an SPI as part of your working time, right? And this is not the same for someone coming from Africa or Asia. In IPES, there is also, again, a mechanism that they got financial support for traveling to meetings, and that covers some of their costs, which is, I think, a nice initiative, but it will not pay for their time, which they spent on the whole process, right? So, yes, there is a resource aspect of this question. But there is also a cultural aspect of this, and I had an experience a couple of years ago where we worked together with an indigenous knowledge holder. And finally, the leaders of the assessment decided that she couldn't contribute as much as it was expected. And that was kind of an end point for her involvement in the process. But actually it was a very difficult situation because for her, contributing to the assessment in the Western way was not a legitimate way. So she did contribute, but in completely other terms than what was respected and accepted by, you know, by our Western culture. And that's why I say that it's not just about resources, it's also about accepting that we have different types of knowledges, we can contribute to these dialogues in different manners, and we need this kind of openness, we need this kind of respect to each other, that sometimes it's not happening by the deadline, sometimes it's not happening in a written form, sometimes these contributions are completely different from what I expected to be. But still, these can be very critical to the process. And it's very hard to talk about co-production with policy if we are unable to co-produce knowledge with our peers who are just coming from a different knowledge domain, right? So I think that it's both the resource and the cultural perspective involved there.
So what's the way forward? If you could suggest the world three things to do differently when it comes to science policy interfaces, what would those three things be?
Yeah, perhaps the first one would be this, to say, fostering co-production. So basically that's all what we discussed so far, with all this necessity of being more open, being able to listen to each other. So that would be the first one. The second one, I would say, to me, is to be more issue-driven. So yes, I think that huge global assessments bring lots of interesting findings, but they are hard to change the world, while working closer on a more, you know, local scale or national scale might have more results on the ground. So that would be the second one, like being more issue-driven. And perhaps the third one is bringing in more facilitation skills. So SPIs work usually in a way that we all assume that those people who are involved will know what to do. But as I said before, we are not trained for that. So I think that all these knowledge co-production processes could work much better if we do have professional facilitation, which helps us in reflecting on our roles, helps us developing the skills we need for being effective on the SPI and stuff like that. And actually, we have now a project at the European scale. It's called BioAgora. It aims to set up a science service for biodiversity at the European scale. And actually, this is one aspect where we are working on now to offer this kind of support in terms of facilitation and capacity development.
And finally, I'm asking you the question we ask all our guests. What's your rebellion?
Yeah, it's a lovely question. And it's hard to respond to that. But to me, I just go back to this idea of disempowerment by Esther Turnout. So I like experimenting with this, that I'm just taking roles which are not necessarily expected from me to take. Like recently, we were working on a reflection paper which aims to analyze how an IPES assessment process were going on. And then I decided to take the roles of the junior colleagues, and I did the fine grain analysis with them. And I think that it was really useful for me and for them. So I think it's always possible that if you are a better established scientist, you can always choose to go back and start it from the beginning and play that role that you are there to learn and to listen. And yeah, I think that's my rebellion, that I'm never, yeah, I'm always eager to start, learn from the beginning.
Many thanks to you, Esther, and thanks to all of you for spending time with us. Stay tuned with us for our next episode. Bye, Esther.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.